Next administrative docket number is 506. This also is a product of, byproduct, I suppose, of the committee that the Board of Governors appointed to study the rules of discipline and the procedures concerning the processing of discipline cases. Mr. Kunze, do you have this one also to present?
Yes, I do, Chief Justice.
Great.
Okay. My question is, would you prefer that we break this into individual parts for public comment, or do you want me to go through all of them?
Well, let me begin by saying, in the interest of time, that all of the justices have read the petition. We've read the material that's here. If there is anything in particular you'd like to highlight, then I think what I'd rather do is just see if there's any comment from other persons or questions, and then perhaps you can assist in answering any questions that lawyers may have about what you have proposed here.
Yeah.
So unless there's anything particularly you'd like to highlight from the various rule changes in this petition, I think we're good to go.
As far as the letter of reprimands go, this is really just just a result, really, from the fact that we've gone from we no longer have private reprimands, and so that one is actually fairly self-explanatory.
I've got a question that goes with that, though. I know that you want to get rid of the private reprimand, but what do we have before that? Like letters of caution? We're still using letters of caution?
That's correct, yes.
What about picking up the phone and just calling an attorney and saying, you've got to do this or you've got to do that? Or we prefer that you do this or that?
We do that at the intake stage. We do have the capabilities of informally resolving, and we do informally resolve many grievances of that nature. But once it gets past the intake stage, then it has to go to a screening panel, and then it's just really up to what the screening panel would do. But the screening panel actually does have, and it's not on, they may decide that they're not going to do anything, but issue some type of a warning. So that possibility is still there. We're also, the rule isn't doing away necessarily with the entire concept of a private reprimand. It's just going to be called a letter of reprimand. It's not public from the standpoint of it's not going to be automatically published. It's available if the public wants it. It's available to them, but it's not put on their profile as is required for an actual public reprimand.
Why do we need it? What do we need that for if we have a letter of caution and the screening panel can say we're just going to warn this person? You know, let me tell you, there's over 300 people taking the bar exam in July, and even if the worst type of percentage that passes, we're going to have 200 new lawyers. And when I was Chief Justice in 2012, I went to major law firms about hiring people. And most of them said, well, we got a law clerk that we're going to hire. So even though the American Bar Association says that Nevada and Utah and Arizona are great places for young lawyers, the great place for young lawyers is they're hanging out their own shingles. And I was a young lawyer some 45 years ago. And luckily, I had good mentors, and we have the TIP program. But you're going to have a lot of young lawyers hanging up a shingle, and they're going to be making mistakes. And to have something like a letter of reprimand?
That's correct, letter.
Do we really need that? I mean, I think that the bar has to take some positive steps to help these young lawyers to make sure that they don't have a record that when somebody checks it out, they're going to see that the guys have been in trouble. In fact, we look to see if what people have had as far as their disciplinary, and this is aside from being a disciplinary matter, but rather appointment as an arbitrator or something that we've asked somebody to be on a commission, and if they've got something in their background, we really don't want them to serve. So I think that you guys have to take a better step and really, really think this as to what you really want to accomplish. With I'm not talking about somebody who's stealing from their trust account. That's easy. What's tough is if somebody makes a mistake or doesn't return the phone calls or is uncooperative with the bar. That before we go to this letter of reprimand, or rather than a private something that's private between the bar and the attorney, that's my view.
And Justice Sutcher, I understand your question, and we do have that with a letter of caution. That is something that we do use.
And the public doesn't see that.
That's correct.
And they cannot see that.
That's correct.
If you call the bar, even if somebody knows what the name of it is, are any letters of caution, you have to say, well, we can't comment on that, or whatever you say to put somebody.
So we have that level. And I guess, you know, from my perspective, as a former prosecutor, you kind of like those step-ups in discipline. And we're not changing the fundamental structure of the way it exists today. Today you have the informals. It's just that really this is an administrative change from the standpoint of where you see throughout the entire rules this whole reference to informal hearings. The impact of this really would be from the standpoint of by eliminating the informal hearings, we're actually proposing then that these become, if there's going to be an appeal from a screening, which is imposing this letter of reprimand, which is not the full-blown public letter of reprimand, the attorney, the lawyer, has the ability to elect to go to, under the current standard, an informal hearing or a formal panel. With these changes, it would actually then really be only one level of hearing, that if you're not going to accept this level of a letter of reprimand at that stage, then it would be pushed to a full-blown, traditionally would be called the formal hearing. But again, I just think it does give us that extra level that it's not out there where as soon as the public reprimand is given, it's published, it's in the Nevada Lawyer, the newspapers are getting copies of it. They're not getting that type of discipline. So it is kind of an intermediate level of discipline.
Okay, just given, did you have a question?
Actually, I think, Mr. Quincy, you answered my question. It was also about the private reprimand issue. So I appreciate your answer. It satisfies my concerns.
Okay, are there any other questions for Mr. Quincy about this? All right, then let's see if there are any comments from members of the bar. Are there any comments in Carson City? Yes, sir, Mr. Hamilton.
Again, good afternoon. My name is David Hamilton. I'd like to answer a question about the letter of caution. They are public records. You can go to the bar and get them. One of the things that I would suggest that be changed is that letters of caution be taken out of Rule 102, subsection 8, so that you can get a letter of caution and it's not discipline. And one of the things in the last two people who have been running the northern part of the state is they're not out to help people. They're out to prosecute cases. And I think that, as you suggested, there ought to be a process where somebody has to come down to the bar office and here's what we think you've done wrong. Please don't do it again in some of these minor cases. But they're not doing that. And I strongly hate this rule 10 or subsection 8 of 102 because you have to report it to your malpractice carrier and it increases your premiums, and yet they're trying to help you by telling you please don't do this anymore, but then the Supreme Court rule makes it discipline which you have to report. I think that's wrong. I want to go back to rule 99. I think there ought to be, in addition to Rule 99, where it says lawyers who do business in Nevada but don't come here, but do send contracts in, give advice to people, they're subject to the disciplinary process. I think that ought to be added in the language of Rule 99. I think that it ought to be made more clear under Rule 103, subsection 5, that the, I don't know what you call them, the big chair here in the Northern Nevada panel, ought to hear motions that might affect how a panel would see something. Some very prejudicial evidence is available, and there's a question of whether it's admissible or not. I think that the big panel chair ought to hear that and make a decision on it so that it doesn't infect the panel that hears the grievance if he says it doesn't come in. I think that they're in 103 subsection 6, they require, if you want to have a five-member panel, I think that you've got to give them more time to make a decision. when you get a complaint and you start investigating as an attorney, sometimes you can't come to the conclusion of what maybe the hearing's going to be like until you spend more time looking at all the evidence. And that might take till after the time for the answer to the complaint is filed. So I think there ought to be an additional time for both the bar and the respondent to ask for a five-member panel, and maybe some standards about when a five-member panel should be allowed. Another thing, in 103 subsection 6, we're having self-selection to some degree of the panel chairs. They send an email around saying, can you chair a panel? And the people respond, yes, I can. And then they call up and find out who it is. And so, therefore, you can select yourself into someone you have a grudge against, maybe, or someone you want to help. I think that there ought to be something done about how we select the panel chairs in that regard. 104 subsection 3 is not going to come into effect very often, but I have a question. It says that if I file a complaint against the Bar Council, it's heard by the Board of Governors. But what's the procedure? How's it done? There's no procedure. I'm sorry, I don't remember what this is, but it goes back to my letter of caution issue. In 105.1a, they shouldn't be allowed to issue a letter of caution. Imagine that you get a grievance, you respond to it, they send it to the screening panel, you get a letter of caution. There's nothing, absolutely nothing you can do about getting that out of your record if you think you had been wrongly cautioned. There's no appeal, no hearing, no nothing. And that's why I think letters of caution ought to go also. Another thing, they have the screening panels, the formal complaints file. They send you a list of people who are on the disciplinary committee, and then you have five challenges to them. This got two problems. One, they don't tell you who was on the screening panel, so you know you don't have to disqualify them because they're not allowed to sit on a hearing panel. There ought to be some mechanism that the people on the screening panel are either not in the list or disclose that they were on the screening panel. Then there's a provision in there where someone is challenged for cause and gets thrown out, and then they bring in somebody else. You can go back if you haven't used all five of your peremptory challenges. You can challenge that person with a peremptory challenge, whereas if they came directly to the panel, you couldn't challenge them with a peremptory challenge. I'm sorry, I don't understand that process. It doesn't make sense to me. There's a provision in 105.2d that says they don't have to disclose impeachment evidence. You got to do that in a civil case. Why are lawyers treated differently than a civil litigant? Why don't they have to disclose impeachment evidence? I don't understand the limitation that's been put there. Then the way the thing is written, the Bar Council has to present a packet or a summary of why you're being charged, what evidence they have, who the witnesses are. But it doesn't say they have to produce the written or the documentary evidence they have. I think they ought to have to produce it at that point. It says that you could come and inspect after up to 3 days before the hearing. Inspect what? It doesn't say what. Then another problem arises. There's no ruling of this court or no rule that sets forth what you can do to defend yourself if it's attorney-client material. Can you use attorney-client material to defend yourself in a bar discipline, or are you bound by the attorney-client privilege to keep it confidential? I don't know how, when an attorney's being sued or trying to collect a debt, you can use attorney-client information, but in a bar hearing, I don't think you can. I don't have much more. In the subpoena area, two things mainly. One, it doesn't say that if you're defending somebody in a bar proceeding, you can issue a subpoena. It doesn't say where you can get one. I've gone to the panel chairs, and they've been kind enough to give me one. But I think, just like the rules of civil procedure, you ought to have the right to write your own darn subpoenas and sign them and issue them, and you bear the responsibility for whether they're correct. The other thing is that they want you to put a confidentiality provision in the subpoenas. Why would you have to subpoena a witness and tell them that they can't talk to anybody, that what they're being subpoenaed for is confidential? This is not the investigative stage. This is afterwards. This is for the hearing. I don't understand why that has to be in there. Then I have a problem with this Rule 121 in the sense that after 4 years, I think it is, or three, I can't remember, they're supposed to throw everything away, and it's not available. But the state bar has it, and when they want to look it up for a disciplinary hearing, they can provide you with the information. Is that rule intended to get rid of everything, including the files of the state bar, or can they keep it and use it later? Thank you very much for your time and consideration of my comments.
Before you step down,
sure.
I guess as a basic theory, I appreciated a number of the insights that you gave to us today. I'm concerned in the initial part because one of the obligations we have with our profession is to protect the public.
That's correct.
And so I'm a little concerned. And I'm a little concerned, having not always had this robe on, but also practiced on the other side. And it's nice to know that the delicacy of the caution.
Yes.
Because when you have someone who has, say, a number of cautions in their file, you eventually say, I've told you, you're not listening, I should go forward, opposed to there's nothing in the file, we have no history, and the first thing the person says, I've never done anything wrong, there's no track record unless it's just word of mouth. How do we begin to balance that? Or should we even consider it? And I am very concerned, as you are, because of the malpractice implications and such.
Yeah, premiums go way up, at least at Alps. I agree with you that there are a lot of people out there that have track records that should be, taken out of the practice of law because they're competent. But then again, there's the people, if you just let them know that they've done something wrong and give them a little guidance, they'll do much better. When I was a beginning attorney, I did some terrible things, and I had people help me. And Rob Baer, a number of times we've talked about different things, and he guided me through, and I've never had a grievance. But I understand what your concern is, that we get somebody who keeps getting letters of caution because they do little tiny things. And maybe the state bar ought to keep a record of that. And after your second or third letter of caution, the scale gets lifted up and we take care of it that way. I hope I answered your question.
Food for thought. Thank you.
Okay. Just Pickering, any questions for Mr. Hamilton?
No, thank you so much for your comments, though. That was very helpful.
Are there any comments or persons in Las Vegas wishing to address Administrative Docket Number 0506?
No, there's not.
Okay.
Mr. Kunze, if you'd like to make any additional remarks before we take this under advisement.
I would. Unfortunately, I thought we were taking a break after that section with the comments, and I apologize for the confusion there. But I do want to clarify one thing on the letters of caution. By the rule, it is listed as a matter of discipline, but it specifically by rule states that it can't be used as an aggravating factor in any additional, any following discipline. So it's kind of it's a weird, it's definitely a weird function out there with this letter of caution, but it is listed as an element of discipline.
Well, should it go one way or the other rather than be in the middle? I mean, this is like ridiculous. It's either a disciplinary issue or it isn't.
That's one of those, odd things that unfortunately it's going to require a change in the Supreme Court rule because that's the way the rule is written right now. The rule right now lists the letter of caution actually as the final element of discipline, but it adds that caveat to it that it's not to be used as an aggravating factor in any substance.
What's your recommendation on should we change that rule? Or since this has been brought up by Mr. Hamilton, do you have any, or you have to defer to the Board of Governors to maybe
advise us
later?
Yeah, I think it's from the Board of Governors, but I think the reality of it is that this court has made the determination that these things are no longer private. The demands from this court were, the instructions in the rules were that we want these to be fully disclosed or available to the public. So I think that's something that obviously the philosophies are on both sides of it, but under the current system, we have to operate within this current system with regards to the confidentiality rules they're enacted now.
Right. I guess I kind of share Justice Cherry's concerns, Mr. Kunze, that we have an awful lot of good attorneys here in the state that maybe once in a while make a mistake. I mean, nobody's perfect, you know, like that. So if these issues can be dealt with, like, informally and not part of files, which can maybe a person 20 years later wants to be a judge or something, and then this comes out and it affects your ability to get selected by the Judicial Selection Commission. So I'd be interested in what you, if you want to comment later in writing, so we can kind of evaluate that.
And I think, I do want the court to understand that the Office of Bar Counsel in administering discipline does exercise a tremendous amount of discretion on what goes forward. And I think you'll see a statistic one of these that talks about the fact that there's about 1,000 grievances every year that we resolve without going forward. So we get about 1,200. I mean, so that tells you basically where we're at with regards to the fact of how we do that. And a lot of that is some type of informal process. Of course, that's one of the other elements of one of the changes to the ADKT is to really give more tools to the Bar Council with regards to the possibility of having them go to the fee arbitration for those types of disputes. So, again, that's just something that is part of this package that does give us that discretion that allows us to informally resolve some of these without going to a formal screening.
Any other questions? Mr. Kunze, yes, did you have something you wanted to add or some other area you wanted to
cover? I did have some other areas if you want me to
yes,
cover
them
or if you have any other questions. I think the big one is the third part, which is the size of hearing panels and the concurrence to impose discipline. We recognize that may be a hot topic, hot button. But the one thing that I did want to add that's really not in the materials is just kind of a pragmatic, but when we look at what we've done over this past year, in trying to restructure the Office of Bar Counsel, where historically the most the office had done was mid-70s as far as hearings per year. Well, this past year, from last July to the present, we did over 120 hearings. We're putting an enormous burden on the volunteer panels. And when you look at the numbers, because of the fact that when you're using a five-person panel, that's four attorneys. And if you look at 120 panels, and I'd say roughly half are informal, either with a conditional guilty plea three-person panel or with the the informal panels, which are the appeals from the letters of reprimand. Those would only be three, which would entail two attorneys on those. When you look at the numbers, it takes basically 360 slots to fill five-person panels under our current system with doing 120 hearings. And we're really not anticipating the luxury of being able to really pull back on the number of hearings that we're doing. And if you currently look at, even with the size of the panels we have, if you look at, say, 60 really active members, that takes six hearings per year, and that really is a tremendous burden. If we were to reduce that down to the three-person panels, that would really reduce that number down to basically four hearings per year. But we've also just initiated an effort, and we have about 20 people that we might be adding to our panels, and that would actually bring it then down to about three panels per year that we could ask our volunteers to do, which we believe is a very workable number, and it would really reduce a lot of the strain on the system. And that's one of the reasons why we would like to push that one.
Do you agree with Mr. Hamilton's characterization of the qualifications of those who are serving as panel chairs as well as the selection process? That description is troublesome if people can informally manipulate what panel they sit on.
I really do not agree with that characterization. First, with the quality of the people that we have sitting on there, and I don't know that you necessarily have to be, quote, a litigator to be able to sit on a panel. And there has not been any issues that really have come forward that anybody can cite to that would deal with evidentiary rulings or incorrect or anything. There's just no record of that. So I definitely disagree with that characterization. I think the panel members we have are very dedicated. Panel chairs have been doing it for many years. They are very experienced. We're not throwing, the chairman of the boards are not throwing inexperienced people in as panel chairs. And we don't see procedural problems. With regards to the manipulation, the way the process is set up, and again, when you look at it from the South panel, I believe the number now is up to 80 that we can have on the disciplinary board. When a complaint is filed, each side can preempt five people. Five people out of 80 is what you can preempt.
In picking that group, then there is a risk that someone may have sat on the screening panel.
Well, screening panel is automatically taken off.
Okay.
So that there, and we run two screening panels in the South, one screening panel in the North. So, and again, if you look at the South, those six or the three that sat on that particular hearing panel are automatically preempted. Then each side can preempt five. So again, you're not appreciably decreasing the pool of lawyers that are available for that panel.
Does the pool reflect a number of sole practitioners and people from like partnerships? I was on the disciplinary panel for years. In fact, I was on the screening. I did a lot of screening. And the only time that it really helped me to have large law firms on my, when I was participating, is when we had the issue of non-refundable criminal fees. Because I had all these hot shots from these big law firms, and a $5,000 non-refundable fee was nothing to them. So we were able to salvage an attorney who otherwise might have been disciplined if it just been some sole practitioners. But I worry about the makeup of the panels as to whether, because most of our disciplinary issues are, it's a major partner from a major law firm. It's usually a sole practitioner or a youngster who's just starting. So I worry about the makeup of these panels.
We actually, for my perceptions, I believe the makeup of our disciplinary panels are really as diverse as our bar is. It is a good representation of our bar. We have sole practitioners. We have people from various fields. And it really runs across the board. So I don't I don't agree with Mr. Hamilton's assertions that, you know, that there's all, you know, certain type of attorneys or anything that are doing this. We don't see evidence of that. I believe it's very diverse, and you do see we have young attorneys, we have older attorneys, and actually what's kind of interesting in this last grouping that we put out, we're actually starting to see some of the older attorneys who are now moving to kind of counsel positions with larger firms now asking to be put on the panels. So, again, I think we're getting a fair representation of our bar.
Are you comfortable with the minority representation on the panels?
From my own personal perspective, we certainly have a fair number of female members on the panels. As far as African-American representation, it's not a tremendous amount. And I think that that's something that really should have, you know, some recruitment with. One of the other areas that I've tried to push for recently is even getting more public attorneys involved. Because I think they're really well suited and have the capabilities of doing it. So there are certainly some elements that I think we do need to try to reach out for. I don't know the numbers, so I don't really necessarily know if the number of minority members that we have on the panels match what would be, say, the makeup of our bar. I don't have that number in front of me, but I can certainly we can certainly look at that and get a report back to this court with regard to that matter.
I know that I was a member of the diversity committee for the state bar, but unfortunately it hasn't been meeting lately. But when I first got on it, we met periodically, and there was great representation in the minority community. I was very proud of that particular committee that I was on.
I will say this, that I don't see any prevalence of any use of peremptory challenges against minority members of the panel, which I think would be an obvious concern if that were to be happening, but I certainly see no evidence of that.
Are there any other areas you wanted to comment on, Mr. Kuzi?
Just quickly, I think there was some reference made to the subpoena issue. Mm-hmm. This is a very housekeeping measure from the standpoint, and very beneficial to us from the standpoint of the way the rule is written. We can't subpoena unless we have an investigation. And so if we get a request from another bar, we can't do the subpoena. And this would help us. But then also, we also have an increasing need to get subpoenas from other states. And without the reciprocity, we really can't do that. The only other point that I really wanted to raise was with regards to the changing of the number of the board. And I do just kind of throw out a caveat that if the board or if the court is not going to want to reduce the panels from 5 to 3, as is recommended in this petition, I think we do have to be careful of making sure that what was now an informal hearing, there needs to be an opportunity or have an avenue available that we can still do 3-person panels for appeals from the screening letters of reprimand. When they get a letter of reprimand, they can appeal it. It would be nice to be able to have that, because if we then started throwing all of those appeals into a full panel, 5-person panel, we are going to magnify the burden on the panels, as you know, when I go through the numbers. So I would hope that would somehow we could fashion a way that we wouldn't lose the capabilities of having a 3-person appeal from a letter of reprimand issued by a screening panel.
Have you thought also about maybe giving a choice to both the person who is going to appear before the panel and the bar counsel, that if somebody wants maybe to get the issue resolved and waiting for 5 takes longer than waiting for 3, that they the two parties can agree to a 3-member panel?
That actually happens fairly regularly.
I know there are attorneys who would like to get their matter resolved, and getting 5 is much more difficult than getting 3 because of people's schedules.
That happens regularly, and a lot of we do that too through the negotiations process. We do a conditional guilty plea. We're able to bring that down to a 3-person panel. and save that burden.
Was there anything else, Mr. Kunze?
That's all I had, unless there's any specific questions from the justices on any of the areas.
Are there any questions from justices? All right. Then here's what I'd like to request, Mr. Kunze. There's been a lot of comment about the various rule amendments in this particular administrative docket number. I know that the Board of Governors is meeting in a week or so, and I assume that they are going to be discussing some of the issues regarding discipline at that meeting. Are you or your colleague expected to make a report at that meeting?
We will definitely have a discipline report at that meeting.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Then what I would like to request is that perhaps, and assuming that this schedule works for you, that you might supplement anything you wish to as a result of any action by the Board of Governors that might be related to this administrative docket number in writing by August 1st. And then we'll take this matter up after we hear any additional commentary from you that reflects the Board of Governors' deliberations on this subject.
Well, we will certainly be able to do that.
And would you include in that a specific list of all of the panel members and a demographic breakdown as to race and sex?
We will also include, because we have 20 that we're petitioning the board to approve, and we'll include all those in, sure, in the list as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that'd be great. All right. Any questions, Justice Pickering, of Mr. Kunze?
No, I have none. Thank you so much.
And Chief Judge, just a quick clarification on the demographics. Do you want a practice area?
Yes.
As well as ethnicity or any of that nature?
Yes, please.
Okay, we'll do that.
Are there any other comments from Las Vegas based on what the discussions have been up here?
Yes, I believe there are.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Kunze.
Mr. Chief Justice, Brian Scott, I'm the current Vice President of the State Bar of Nevada. Thank you, Justices. I was just listening back there to the supplemental information that you requested from us. We don't track race. So that would be a little bit more difficult to do.
Oh, okay.
So we could track the sex, of course, and the probably the locations of the members, but race isn't.
I would ask that for purposes of this, that you do so. That falls in the ambit of the Batson issue that's before the court, both civil and criminally, and it's something that we need to look at in terms of the diversity of the bar. And so I would ask that you make an attempt to look at that, because you're not looking at the full 9,000 membership of the bar. You're looking at a smaller group. If you can, great, but give us what information you can.
We will try to do that, Justice. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else wishing to make comments from Las Vegas? All right.
No, that's it.
Then, subject to the supplemental information that the bar may wish to offer, this matter will also stand submitted, and the court will be in recess. I'd like to again express my sincere appreciation to all of those who participated in the various administrative matters. I'm working my tail off, along with my colleagues, to see if we can get these administrative matters caught up and concluded this year. So thanks for your input, and the court will be in recess.